Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 102, where Leonardo, Miranda, Rowan, and Tom are discussing the book My Years at General Motors by Alfred P. Sloan Jr., originally published in 1963 by Doubleday. In part two, we will discuss the later years of Sloan's experiences, followed by how the automotive industry and industry more generally has changed since the 1960s. This will allow us to examine the continued relevance of some of Sloan's lessons about professionalism in business. If you missed part one, please visit our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. Okay, in part one, we touched a number of topics that are covered in the book. And with it being a big book, we only scratched the surface in a lot of areas. So what we'd like to do is to start by continuing the conversation of some of the segments of the book that we hadn't really delved into, or some parts of the history that we haven't delved into, and then get into more contemporary implications of the text. I think a couple of parts of the history that we did not discuss in much detail so far has been after the Depression, because from the Depression to World War II to the 1950s, which is when the book starts to reach its, the story starts to reach its conclusion, when the automotive boom, big automotive boom occurred. And throughout, there have been all of these different segments of time in which the demands changed, the requirements changed, the relationship, labor relations and other things changed. And there was a lot of fits, stops, reverses. I mean, looking at it in hindsight from about 90 years past, it all looks like it was smooth and wonderful. But all of these episodes, there were some pretty harsh lessons learned. But I think that there are some wonderful lessons to be learned. And I think I'm going to highlight one from the 1940s, because that was the period of World War II. And I think what Sloan showed through the use of his committees, we talked about how he started these committees. Well, how did he put them to use as we suddenly shifted from this depressed but peacetime period to war production when the country started to nationalize industry? And even more importantly, I think for present purposes, our purposes here, was how the organization, the corporation, prepared itself for the post-war period. He talks in the book at several places about how the shift to war preparations or war production meant that General Motors had to develop and produce materiel that they had never developed or produced previously. And they had to do it on a massive scale. And in order to do that, there was a deliberate effort led by the, policy and the committees and so forth to overcome those problems. But then at the end, there was this issue of, now that you created this massive infrastructure with hundreds of thousands of people employed, and the war ends, and then all of a sudden, the cancellations of all the orders start coming in, and you're talking about a sudden loss of about $2 billion of business. And the complete retooling back to a peacetime mode in which you're going to start producing ordinary automobiles again. And the ability to do that, I don't want to say minimal, but with an acceptable level of risk and an acceptable amount of disruption to the company, on a surface, it sounds extraordinary. And he covers in here how they did it, just through basically this coordinated decentralization of allowing all of the divisions to re-engineer, repurpose themselves for the significant sudden changes in the market.
Yeah, I'm actually curious, perhaps, to your thoughts, Tom, on a step before that, which is Sloan talks about how they first had to break that down before building it back up against the war and, sorry, after the war. And he talks about during World War II, they did about $12 billion of business, out of which 17% of the products sold, 13% were original GM products with no major design changes. So kind of diesel engines, trucks, and so forth. Everything else in out of that $12 billion of production was set up for the war. And then at the same time, again, to continue setting the ground for how they had to then unpack everything post-war, there were over 100,000 employees had left to go fight in the war. It's not even as if the talent still remains and you have to just switch modes of thinking among the same people. It was a massive upheaval at the time, which I found impressive just in terms of that quick responsiveness where you're able to make over 80% of your product be new design or designed by someone else or co-designed with the military with brand new kind of talent and staff, and then pivot back, like you were suggesting, to the post-war era as well.
I'll just give a quick answer. You know, my impressions are just in general, wow. You know, the scale is immense. And we always think about in periods of time when you're facing great national competition or international competition is the potential of, you know, if it were to come to it, could you replicate it? You know, of course, Sloan is only talking from the corporate standpoint. Of course, you know, there's every nation has its mechanisms by which it says, all right, in the event of a national emergency, we can press certain things into service in order to be able to generate that kind of capability. But of course, it also assumes that you have sufficient real estate or real property, factories, floor space that you can convert, that you have the know-how how to convert it, that you have the skilled labor and unskilled labor in adequate quantities in order to be able to do it. I mean, those are a lot of considerations that no one corporation is going to have all that much control over. It's hard to imagine, you know, the level of turmoil that really was undergoing in that corporation because on the one hand, you've got to have the home front to be able to produce the goods. And on the other hand, you're supplying personnel to the war effort. It is intense. And then again, when it's over, in that case, it was really sudden. And then it's like, now what? So it was really wise, you know, taking the text for its word, that they had already done the post-war planning a couple of years into the war. They didn't wait until the end to react. They were thinking ahead, saying, we know that this is going to end at some point. What is it going to do? So they were at least able to respond in some way, not just with having to stop the lines, but also to get things retooled and back. It really is tremendous, you know, what they accomplished.
Yeah, and I do think, picking up on what you just said, Tom, Sloan would argue and is kind of implicitly arguing that some of the things he put in place earlier, for example, we talked about information and forecasting, they're useful for wartime. And he gives great examples in chapter 20 about how quickly demand fluctuates during the war as events on the battlefield change. And they were useful after wartime as well, because it's the same, you know, you might change your horizon of forecasting, but once you've got the system in place of each division rolling up their numbers, having these interdepartmental committee meetings, and sticking to the discipline of having some projections, Sloan seems to, you know, his thesis seems to imply that it holds you in good stead in both war and peacetime. And the other thing you said is also something I had picked up on, which is they seemed to have quite a bit of foresight where they were planning for wartime operations in 1940, so much before things geared up and you know, much before Pearl Harbor. And they were planning for peacetime operations much before the war ended. And I think it is not too much of a stretch to say that Sloan would have had a big part to play in just bringing in that kind of a structure where you're planning so many years ahead.
It's also a product of the experiences in the 20s and 30s where they had already gotten accustomed to the idea that demand fluctuates significantly. This was not new to them. I think that was very significant, because Sloan, being there for so long, had seen all of these ups and downs before and had therefore been able to position the corporation with all the governance structures or whatever. It, you know, along with it comes the mindset of, you know, we know that we're in a very unstable business. Demand can change significantly based on the economic situation in the country. And if we don't posture ourselves, if we don't think proactively, we'll get caught. So an organization that doesn't have that experience is, I can imagine, would have had a much, much more difficult time doing that same level of overall, you know, transformational activity.
I try to add something here because we are talking about how the corporation is dealing with a lot of things at once, a lot of activities going on, a lot of research going on. Chapter 14, the technical staffs, he began with General Motors is an engineering organization. Our operation is to cut metal and in so doing to add value to it. So I think he started talking about when, by the time of the release of the book, he's talking about 19,000 engineers working on the organization. This is huge. A lot of people doing regular and also some kind of research job. So I'm trying to put some to relate what you guys are talking earlier, but he got a sense of what he have to do with the organization, what's the core business of this organization. And I think that all other things that he's talking about the book comes along with the primary function, that is how to cut metal. I don't think so, but, you know, it's kind of idea that you have this core that you have to protect and try to improve. And maybe this is something that he developed, Tom, when you are dealing with the 20s, you know, because that is the scaling that you have to manufacture the car, but you have to sell it and you have to deal with the different markets. So let me pass over to you.
No, it's okay. I think what you spurred in my mind is vertical integration, because I think that's one of the other things that perhaps was advantageous for them that has since come, I don't want to say quite a dirty word, but it's not something that you see so much anymore. Somewhere in the book, I forget where, he mentions that, you know, GM was in just about all of the aspects of the development, production, and distribution and sales of the automobile, except for the generation of raw materials. That's pretty well vertically integrated. When you're dealing with cutting metal, when you're dealing with handling, you know, physical goods, there's something to be said about the adaptability that you might have by having those assets within the corporation, that you can say, okay, we have this particular thing that's coming up, we can put this team on it to go develop a new type of a car and see what happens or whatever. Whereas that also incurs a bit of a sunk cost of having those assets on hand, not necessarily fully employed all the time, which then, you know, in later times when vertical integration became less
in vogue, yeah.
Yeah, less in vogue.
Less in fashion.
Yeah. You gain efficiencies because now you're not spending that sunk cost, you're outsourcing, but you lose a certain amount of the adaptability unless you really know what you're doing when you set up the outsourcing. So everything about it, and I think one of the things he talked about a lot, especially because it was all embedded in his discussion of how he came up with coordinated decentralization in the first place, it's all about trade-offs at some point. And here's another case of a trade-off that we see coming out of it. He's built his corporation a certain way in which it relies on heavy vertical integration. Now, the trade-off being that you have this huge sunk cost of the enterprise of all of these white-collar workers. What are they doing? How are they adding value to the firm? Let's start slicing and dicing. Let's re-engineer the firm to make it more lean, to seek efficiency, which could, in theory, translate into lower costs for the consumer. I think it's useful to go back to this book to look to it for the arguments for vertical integration. If we ever find ourselves, and maybe arguably we are, coming to the point where we're realizing the problems of not having vertical integration, you know, what are the risks entailing with that? especially if, say, we continue to have supply chain issues and we have to, you know, we can't rely on outsourcing the way we've been accustomed to. And hope that makes sense.
I think I also wanted to connect a little bit to Leonardo's point that he made earlier around sort of the approach that Sloan adopted. And I found it fascinating to go back to his biography, where he comes from a background of engineering. So to a certain extent, it kind of makes sense as to how he's approached the organization in terms of different components and sort of piecing them together, but also seeing this approach of at the end, we're cutting metal, making it into something that is valuable with that ongoing idea of we are here to make money. And I think that is something that informs a lot of his interpretation of the information or of the data and his decision making accordingly. The other thing that I wanted to say was that Sloan, to a certain extent, has grown up alongside the industry of cars, basically. So I feel that it's quite fascinating to think about him coming of age just as one of the first, I can't remember if it was an engine or one of the first cars of a certain kind was developed. And then he carries through the company with all these different stages until we approach what we actually see as more close to today's positioning of the industry, which is where a car is sort of taken for granted. While, as Tom correctly pointed out at the beginning of our conversation, it was actually a luxury item. While today, I mean, I think every household has at least two cars on average, maybe even three if you look at certain households. So I thought it was just interesting to see the person, the motivations, in a sort of as a way to inform and to understand a little bit more all of these decisions that actually can then be translated into major concepts such as vertical integration and this idea of sort of financial controls and so on.
Yeah, thank you, Miranda. Perhaps what we can do is now start to look at where this text fits sort of in the contemporary scheme of things. I mean, vertical integration is one example of how things have changed since the writing. This book, the conclusion of the story was basically around the time in which the automobile was in its real heyday, with the full development in the United States of an interstate road system, which is basically the equivalent of the Autobahn. It was new. It was exciting. We had come to the point where the annual model was now a really big thing, and he does talk about how that came to be. So now every single year, we can trade in our old cars and buy a new car less expensively, and they're becoming that much more capable. But there came international competition. You know, at the time, there weren't foreign manufacturers in the United States. He talks about the global. We didn't talk much about GM going global. GM's established factories in other countries, and since the time period covered in the book, other countries are setting up factories in the United States. And I admit it, I drive Toyotas. So, you know, there's kind of like, what lessons does what he says still have value for today? And also, where does this fit in the business school curricula? Are the lessons the right ones? What do we take away from that?
I would say that there's kind of two sides to it. One is there are elements in there that are useful, relevant, applicable today, but also trivial, where I was, for example, things like the financial controls, the cash control and forecasting and reporting and consolidating your reports. I was surprised that these were new even to him, even I found myself wondering, you know, so what did the railroad corporations do in the late 19th century if these kinds of controls weren't in place? So there's some element of the wisdom in this book that is still useful, but so much so that it's, you know, everyone does it. It's a given, essentially. It's table stakes. But there's other elements that I found very interesting, which even Sloan perhaps doesn't emphasize as much. And so one example I wanted to share was when he talks about committees, and we've talked a bit about his idea of decentralized coordination and how having these interdivisional committees are important to it. But we've talked about it more from a perspective of information control and policy setting. But there are two other benefits that Sloan does mention in passing in his chapter on the committees, which would fit closer to what in management academia we would refer to as perhaps more of, you know, communities of practice rather than a policy committee. And so he talks about, you know, how there were committees of the purchasing people across divisions, of the advertising people, of the salespeople. Each of them had these kind of interdivisional committees. And I just want to quote what he says about the technical committee. So the general technical committee, which was, again, engineers from across these divisions. He says, "It was the mildest kind of organization. Its most important role was that of a study group." So again, he doesn't emphasize it, but immediately as a modern management scholar, these things kind of spark your attention. He says, "It got to be known as a seminar. Its meetings usually were opened with the reading of one or two papers on a special engineering problem or device, and these would be the center of a general discussion. Sometimes the committee's discussion would conclude with the approval of a new device or method, or a recommendation on policy and procedure, but more often the results were simply that information was transmitted from one to all." And so there's that organizational learning aspect that would be familiar to a lot of us today that crops up, at least between the lines, in some of this. The second kind of committee benefit that gets even more of a passing mention, but still kind of caught my attention, was when he talks about the advertising committee, and he says, "It was assumed the value was negligible compared to other benefits accruing to the corporation, but the working together spirit of all members and the formation of a General Motors atmosphere, keeping these in mind, the cost was well justified." So again, this idea of how the committee helps you form a culture of sorts across that spans across these divisions, and what he calls the working together spirit, were also a bit more modern now when you read those aspects of his treatment of decentralized coordination.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that last example, because it was a running theme in the book of trying to balance the need to preserve the culture of the divisions or the identity of the divisions while still establishing some sort of a centralized identity or a corporate identity. And he did lament in some cases that he felt uncomfortable in those instances in which he had to centralize certain functions, such as the marketing. Because it ran against his preferred mode of decentralization, but he justified it in terms of the overall cost and benefit.
And I think this kind of culture, and we got some themes around maybe something related like Marx, exploitation and exploration, and want to stress his ideas on the distinction between innovation and invention. And I think it is interesting because it showed how General Motors worked with these teams. Maybe because of his long distance scene on the automobile market. Despite the picture that we made, I want to quote a funny slogan that he said, "Many bright automotive ideas ended with a horse, a town line, and a laughter." He has this discussion about the distinction between innovation and invention. So he's discussing whether General Motors should invest on basic research. And even if their primary objective is to cut metal, they have to cut in the best way. And basic research, it's the source of these new novel ways of doing things. But he said that this is something that the university should do, not the company. The company, and this is a kind of a regular way to understand the business of the company, is to innovate, to put new products on the market. He had to make this in a faster, profit way. So I think he got this cautious idea of what the company had to do in terms of knowledge. Even though the company has to create knowledge, as Horin is saying, I think he's very suspicious about the way companies do knowledge and in a very circumscribed way of where the company had to work. And I think when he discussed the Coca-Cola engine and all the ideas of Mr. Kettering, he's always very cautious about what kind of knowledge the company can or could have to create. Maybe it's better. So the company is not the university, and all the ideas and the knowledge that the company produced have to be evolved. They have to have some relation with the core business of the company. And this is, I don't know if today where this idea of the knowledge create company would be so circumscribed as he put it back in the 60s in the book was launched.
I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, there's always a challenge of defining that line between basic and applied research. You know, you can say on the one hand that we won't do basic research because that belongs in the university. On the other hand, what if that basic research doesn't get pursued? And who's funding that basic research? You're in effect turning it over to somebody else. And I think sometimes that's why if it's basic research and things that don't require a whole lot of material, or I'm remembering back to my software engineering days where so much basic research shifted into private companies. As a matter of fact, that was kind of in the early days of the startup, pre-internet. You know, you get somebody who knows how to program and they can basically just do all kinds of research on their own and spit out something on a floppy disk. And if it works, it works. You know, our whole thinking of that has kind of evolved depending on which type of products you're talking about.
I think also to continue the conversation on this work in relation to management scholarship, broadly speaking, there are a couple of sort of important things to bear in mind about the specific context, which is obviously that Sloan, to a certain extent, inherited an organization which was disorganized but large. So it was the product of a number of sort of acquisitions, or I can't remember the correct terminology, but a number of divisions that had their role to play. At the same time, he had this endeavor to kind of create structure, and that was fine. If we were to critique it, obviously, perhaps we have other expectations around management scholarship. So we've looked at works that have taken a closer look at the worker, for instance, their motivations, group settings, and we can name all the previous episodes that have danced around kind of those core concepts with different works. I think to a certain extent, perhaps expecting him to also have that conversation is a little bit too much, because it's very clear that Sloan sits in the upper management, talks to those people, and it's as if all the rest just doesn't fall into his focus. And we could ask ourselves why, but it's also true that this product, this book, was written in the 60s and it was reflecting on work that had happened in the 50s and before. So to a certain extent, if I were to situate it within the conversation on management scholarship, I see it as the beginning of a journey that then continues looking into further layers and further puzzles of how to manage people to the best. And I think it's just because at that time there were other priorities, so to speak, and we're obviously talking about an organization that has scaled because of the war, but cannot descale. So we're not talking about smaller places or places that have the opportunity to reduce in size. And I think that's important to bear in mind if we were to reflect on this work within the context.
Yeah, and I mean, one more organized or at least management literature concept that Sloan himself emphasizes a lot in this book, not as a academic concept, but as a real world application, is product market fit. And for him, a lot of the success of GM over Ford came through that. And that has been an enduring concept. Recently, I was listening to an interview of Sundar Pichai of Google, and he was talking about how, you know, what impressed him about ChatGPT was less the technology, more the product market fit and how people immediately were taken to it. And then in our literature, we've got lots of kind of papers from the 90s and et cetera that talk about it. Sloan has a very good description of how the changing market forces leveraged the GM model over the Ford model. And he talks about how kind of Ford had the static model of you've got this one car, it's cheap, it works well, this is your transportation vehicle. But meanwhile, the market had shifted towards closed cars. So you had more material, you need to handle the weight of the closed car. It was less seasonally used throughout the year. B, towards trade-ins. So you would trade in a used car, and then C, towards kind of annual updates to cars. And all of these then led to a kind of a constellation of forces that led to the result that now when a customer is trading in their car, they don't just want to replace, they want an upgrade. They want something nicer than what they had. And that's when having a GM style ladder of cars, so it started with Chevrolet and ended with, I think, Cadillac, ended up winning over the Ford model. And for Sloan, that is a very important component, which is having a concept of what your market looks like and a concept of your and a product policy that matches your concept of what that market looks like. But at the same time, to add a critique to this, although Sloan does speak quite a bit to this idea of product market fit, he, and again, it's like you were saying, Miranda, it's not, I don't mean to ask too much of him personally or of his ghostwriter for that matter, but what the book is lacking is a theory of change and how you adapt. So there's a sense of optimal solution where this is what decentralized coordination looks like. This is what it solves. This is why you need a product policy, but less of a sense of how do you then take it apart and does the same solutions actually not work when, for example, as Tom, you were mentioning, when Japan comes into the picture, when cars become smaller, when you're operating in markets where there isn't maybe a used car system, and which is why then you can sense that as you go forward from where Sloan is writing, this book was published in 63, some of the concepts that he talked about might not have played out as well in the applied market.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. Because we lack the theory of change, because he talks more about kind of retrospectively, did this work or not? What I don't have a full sense of, apart from some particular anecdotes, is did the market drive the change or did the change drive the market? And I think the answer is a little bit of both, but it's hard to parse that out in some instances. In some cases, like with the World War II example, it very clearly they were proactive. But when it comes to some of the finer details, like when he discusses the evolution of the automobile, which is early in part two, and talks about things like the development of the automatic transmission, it included the change of the gasoline and some of the fits and starts that had and some of the accidents that occurred. The front wheel suspension and the tires. I mean, some of the things that nowadays are just so well understood. It's hard to know, you know, are they trying to develop something to drive market change or is this in response to the market? And because he's looking back retroactively or retrospectively, it's hard to tell the difference in some cases. The gasoline was out of necessity because the gasoline was so, the product was inferior at the time in which he started. So anything that improved the ability for the gasoline to be used, you know, that you can kind of see be evolving on behalf of the company. But the transmission was a different story, given how much they were failing at developing an automatic transition over the period of some, I guess, about 15 years. You know, were they creating a product that really had demand or were they just anticipating it or what? It's hard to tell from this text.
Definitely on board. In fact, there's a quote I wanted to share on that because I remember having the same thought as you, Tom. Part of what Sloan seems to be dealing with is what anyone doing a history or a historical look deals with, which is what came first, the change or the actions that drove the change. When he does talk about kind of how the automobile market transformed over time, Sloan says, this ties back also to what we were discussing in terms of, for example, you know, the used car model came in and annual changes came in. Sloan explicitly says, each of the new elements of change had a separate beginning and rate of development before they all interacted to cause complete transformation. Now, while that is descriptively true, it's not at all clear to what extent they anticipated it or they even preempted it through their actions in the market. And that remains a bit murky throughout the book.
Or is it selective memory? That's another possibility.
Or maybe who gave the answer was Chandler when he said the strategy follows the structure. Analyzing the GM case, so they were prepared when the time arrived, they at the front, they gained the market, maybe.
Yeah, excellent point, Leonardo. Thanks. But let's go also back to Miranda's question about where this kind of fits in the current management canon. And, you know, we're now in a period, contemporary period, where a lot of industry, and it's not about physical things so much now. It's software, it's automation, it's apps, it's Uber, it's a whole different
marketplace.
Are there things about what we take away from this book that apply well or don't apply well to contemporary industries or contemporary firms?
I mean, if I can also add to your list, which was very well executed, I'd say we're also in the economy of the sharing, right? The sustainability, the what's it called? Those companies where you can rent a car, the sort of Uber of renting cars. I can't remember. There are a couple of Zipcar, something like that. I would really sort of really like to be able to talk to Sloan and ask him, what do you think about all of this? I don't know. I find it a little bit difficult because at least for the organizations and the businesses that I tend to observe and analyze, we're really talking on a smaller scale. The big ones are really, at least in my eyes, those that work sort of around information. So I don't know. It's really difficult. And I think there is something about this cutting metal, which was important at that age, that really changes structural choices when you're actually not cutting metal. You're doing something intangible to a certain extent, and you're doing it from home, and you've got workers God knows where. So I don't know. It's really difficult. Don't know what others think.
Yeah, I agree with what both of you just said. I think the landscape has changed just immeasurably since the GM that's been described in this book. But I think perhaps some of the tensions that he describes are enduring, especially if you're in a multi-product organization versus someone who's just making one kind of thing. But the solutions might not hold because the solutions kind of are predicated on some kind of a hierarchical organization structure with certain kind of power differences and almost on this multi-divisional structure, all of which goes away when you're working as a platform or you have people just independently contracted out. So I'm not sure about the solutions, but I would imagine that some of the core tension, at least to me, the core tension he's dealing with is the tension between centralization and decentralization will definitely play a role in today's world as well.
Also, I just want to add that there's a discussion in the literature about the importance of doing things at home. So despite the fact that we will not have this size of corporation anymore, I think it's important. For example, there is the work of Gary Pisanos from Harvard saying that the importance to insource things today to try to create these learning communities, as Rory was putting, because you disperse. If you put all your operations abroad, one of the things that happens is that you are putting knowledge abroad too. Not that the idea is to create this big corporation, but the idea, I think Sloan is clear on this, it's the importance of have some kind of common knowledge, common understanding inside the organization to build things. The idea of some kind of centralization on this knowledge creation, maybe it's coming back, because back in the 80s and the 90s, the idea of outsourcing in terms of cut costs and all the things, maybe now I think it's a little bit other discussion, because, you know, you have to create all this knowledge inside one organization and all the things that comes along with this as tacit knowledge. And maybe Sloan could help in this new idea as how to integrate all this knowledge in one organization.
Yeah, thanks, Leonardo. And what that kind of spurred in my mind is going back to the governance function. And what do we mean by big? You know, because we might be accustomed, for example, to thinking about a corporation or a firm size according to certain tangible products or certain tangible components, like how many numbers of workers or how much stuff rolls off the assembly line or things like that, which is a little bit different for a firm like Google, where, Google does have quite a large number of employees, but its influence is kind of outsized what its physical structure is. I think the metaphors that we use to describe an organization might not have caught up with the different ways in which we think organizations are structured.
I think maybe, and trying to relate what you said on what I think our episode on American Factory showed this importance of if you build an organization, if you outsource, it doesn't mean that the organization will function well. And this is interesting because all the conflicts that arise when people are dealing with manufacturing something, and there's a lot of difference between an American plant and a Chinese plant. So this is what very interesting. I think Sloan would enjoy this documentary and our episode because many other things that he said, I think we touch upon. For example, all the different cultures of the Chinese employees and the American employees and how this affects the productivity. So, and we are, as we are talking about in source, I think the idea that Sloan is putting how to deal with different backgrounds, different technical committees, different products, different pieces of the automobile, still very interesting for today.
I think Sloan would take issue with this episode because I've been referring to all of you by first name and he'd find that very improper. No, I just, final thought I wanted to share was, this is clearly a book of historical significance as well as org theoretical significance. But at the same time, I think many of your copies will have this where we've got, there's a blurb from Bill Gates on top of the cover where he says, if you have to read one book on business, this should be it. If I met Bill, I'd have to ask him why he liked it that much.
Yeah, I would never recommend anybody read one book on anything. This is a very, very good book, but I strongly encourage reading of other perspectives on this matter. This is an executive view, and it's only one perspective, and there are many others. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.